Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Interest rates on long-term treasuries have started to drop. Ross checks out the U.S. and Canadian dollars, crude, and gold. Martin Armstrong from Armstrong Economics tells us what the real rate of inflation is, and it's more than three times what the government claims it is. He says his numbers are not biased like the official ones are. Longtime BC trader Victor Adair comments on future rate hikes, Tesla, Apple, bonds, energy, and gold. He believes those who tell you what to expect perhaps are just engaging in wishful thinking. At the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Misalgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how are the markets reacting in the first week of the new year?
This is just a lot of chatter once again. Finished the week very, with some big moves, but overall, since we got to Christmas and through, it's just been, a day up and a day down in every market. And the tail end of the week, the employment numbers, soft numbers in the U.S., enough to take some of that fear on the interest rate side of the equation out of the market's perspective right now. And, you know, if we take a look at it, the U.S., that two-year yield, just in the span of a day, dropped from 4.5% down to 4.25%. You got the 10-year yield in the last 10 days has dropped from, 4.15 down to 3.85. So just a lot of uncertainty in terms of this interest rate scenario as we move through the end of this year. But at this point, with the decline in rates that we saw at the end of the week, it really has put a kibosh into the bounce that we were seeing in the U.S. dollar. The dollar had been down for the better part of the last couple of months, and then made a nice reversal since Christmas, but gave that back at the end of this week. And, it's hard to say just how well we'll hold here. 103.90 on the U.S. dollar index. Still think that there's support in this 103 range. Resistance, maybe, if it can really come to life, could be up around 108.
What's the story on the Canadian dollar?
With this move in the rates, on term, the narrowing right now on the Canadian versus U.S. Rates, we're at the lowest spread that we've seen since October, and so that's put a bid under the Canadian dollar. We thrashed around a bit in the early part of the week, down around 73 cents, but closed up at 74.25. Still within the broad range that it's had here for this last 4 or 5 months, but pretty good end of the week. A lot of resistance is still up in that 75, 75 and a half cent range, but at least it's got some bit underneath there right now, just on the interest rate side of things. And with the move that we saw in the crude oil market, that was a little bit supportive at the tail end of the week, but we've only got about a 73.75 as far as the crude oil market is concerned. There's not no strong bid in there right now. A weaker economy would tend to give us lower prices as far as oil is concerned. And I've still got, you know, these major downside measurements coming out of this consolidation that we had in the summer. And we take a look at the measurement, the height of that consolidation. It had been measuring down to about $60. So I wouldn't put that out as a an impossibility. I think there's a pretty good chance that we could still see a big clean out in the oil market before it has a chance to make its next concerted move to the upside.
What's happening with gold?
Gold had a great week. Ended up with the best prices that we've seen now since back in June, up around the 83 or 1865 to 1870 range. Starting to get a little ahead of itself. We are in the strong seasonal period that does take us into February. When I take a look at the technicals, the weekly charts at this point have moved this week into an overbought territory. We use the sequential as one of our indicators, and that's now had nine consecutive weeks above 4 weeks earlier. That type of movement, we've got 32 examples of this out of 35 since 1980, where the market has then found a temporary top and then pulled back to supporting moving averages. So at this point, I think you're probably looking for a bit of a roll as far as gold is concerned. Maybe it pops through to something into the 1900s, but I think the next real concerted move to the upside probably comes after a decent correction, that's probably, as I say, first week was maybe a lower low would be the catalyst for the start of that correction.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, Martin Armstrong, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Armstrong, founder of Armstrong Economics, available online at armstrongeconomics.com. He's speaking to us from Florida. Marty, welcome back to This Week in Money, and Happy New Year.
Oh, Happy New Year. Although I understand they're bringing a lot of the migrants up there now.
Well, it's always been the situation. Somebody somewhere is going to try to get across a border. Sometime.
Yeah. Yeah, they're just, it's very, very interesting situation. But
and officially, Canada had almost 500,000 migrants or immigrants in 2022.
Well, what's actually been going on is that they've been rejecting, and this includes the United States, they've been rejecting anybody really from Asia and from Europe. And even if you look at Homeland Security, they said that anyone from Ukraine, if they're not vaccinated, would have to be returned. But then the next paragraph says, but if they come in through, Mexico, it's okay. They don't need vaccinations. it's just, so biased and the way everything is being, directed here.
Earlier this week, you posted a real inflation rate for 2022 of 32%. First, yep. What is the definition of the real rate of inflation?
We basically measure it very simply. That is the fuel and energy costs and transportation. You have to understand, when the CPI indexes that all these governments put out, the more you keep putting stuff into it, the lower the number comes. So they count paper clips and, I mean, everything imaginable to bring down, the average number, because if you put in 500 things, then, the top 20, are basically diluted. So, I mean, that's really what goes on. That's how they manipulate things. And I would say that, you have to also understand that the way this operates is that, that each country manipulates what they actually use it for. But if for example, all social programs are automatically indexed to the CPI, the spending for each agency is automatically indexed. So the more they can lower that, effectively, the greater the tax collection is and the lower their spending is on everything else. But if you look across the board, you take diesel fuel and heating fuel. That came in at like up 65%. Eggs were even up almost 50%. Airline, costs, that was up almost 40%. Butter, that came in like 35%. I mean, even bread came in at like 16%. So how do you come up with just, inflation's only 2 or 3%? It's by putting in everything else under the sun that doesn't move. When real estate used to be in there, that was going up a lot in the 80s. So they took it out and they replaced it with rents. And then when the rents were going up, they put it in with, they changed it to the controlled rents like in New York. So, anything they could do to keep these, the inflation numbers down, they're happy. But our number of 32% basically is just taking food, energy, and transportation. And we are not counting, things like, paper clips and things of that nature. Even taxes have gone up, greater than their CPI numbers.
Yeah, governments don't include taxes in the cost of living, do they?
No, they do not.
How did Socrates end up with the real rate of inflation being 32% last year?
Because basically we're just tracking all the real commodities that the average person would be using. We're just not concerned with, all the other nonsense that they put in there. We do include, tax rates. And so, the 32% is more of a realistic number that I think probably all your listeners would agree with. I know my mother would go to the store and the milk would be up, and then she'd say, how come it's only supposed to be 1% and it cost me 10% more? This is why.
How high would interest rates need to go to fight this real rate of inflation?
Probably back to the 8% level. That's really the historical norm. And you have to compensate at least, the people willing to lend money for inflation. If inflation is 32% and I can borrow money at 2%, that's great. I mean, that's fantastic for me. The person that's lending it is losing everything under the sun.
To get this real rate of inflation, was 32% more money added to the system in the U.S. last year?
No, it's not really a question of adding the money. You have different forms of inflation, and what we're dealing with is shortages. And, in part, I think that, China has done a little bit of intentional shutting down, in retaliation against the West to some degree. But, our politicians they wouldn't be qualified for a dog catcher. I mean, it's pretty bad. I mean, the fact that if they stand up and say, oh, we have to sanction Russia because they went into Ukraine. They have no idea of what they're actually sanctioning. They had no idea that, oh, gee, what about, 30% of the world's wheat supply comes from that area, and you also have fertilizer that comes from that area. And so I go, oh, gee, we didn't think about that. Well, this is the whole problem. The same thing with the interest rates. When the ECB lowered interest rates to negative in 2014, I warned them straight up. I said, you're going to wipe out the pension funds. And they don't listen. I mean, you then have laws that say the pension funds mandatorily must have government debt because it's more secure. Okay, but now you're paying them negative. And this is what's the problem here, because you've wiped out in Europe so many of the pension funds. They're sitting there with huge losses. This was the problem with the bond crisis and that emerged in London. Since 2014, you've had these institutions buying these long-term bonds from Europe and even the United States at low interest rates. As soon as the interest rates start to go up, they have to compensate on that bond and selling it to whatever somebody else would buy if it was covering. So the amount of losses in the bond market and among institutions on average is even going up to like 40%. It's astronomical. And they don't consider anything. I mean, honestly, there should be a law that politicians aren't allowed to screw with the economy at all, because they don't understand it and they only manipulate it for their own personal gain politically.
Any thoughts on the real rate of inflation in Canada?
It's about the same, because this is really, it's a little higher because of the currency differences. But, again, we're looking at the main raw commodities that people use, and energy, and that's on a global scale. I mean, it's very nice. I mean, I think even the head of Greenpeace came out against these people, and they're saying, you want to cut down fossil fuels and stuff. How are you going to get the food into the cities? Horse and buggy? There's just no practical understanding of what their, these ideas really are. We're going into solar minimum, which probably will not peak until about 2025 with the solar energy. And, I mean, every correlation study shows that when you go into solar minimum, you get colder, temperatures, and be more violent, and you get more earthquakes and volcanoes. So, I mean, the theory has been that, the gamma rays are different in solar minimum, and they penetrate into the earth, and maybe that is what stimulates the volcanic activity, etc. But our concern should be more about worrying about, if you get a two or three of these volcanoes that go off seriously, then you create a solar winter. I mean, that's what defeated Napoleon. There's a book you can probably get off of Amazon, The Year Without a Summer, which was 1816 when Krakatoa erupted. It throws so much ash into the atmosphere that the sun doesn't penetrate. And it was snowing in New York City in July. So these are not things that are created by, you know, soccer moms driving SUVs. I mean, there are a lot of other things that have major impact on the climate that has got nothing to do with what we do.
Can Socrates predict where inflation is headed in 2023, and what is Socrates?
Yes, inflation appears to be headed up into 2024. And this is, again, this type of inflation is different. It is on the back of shortages. And I mean, I just went to the store this morning to, you know, go get some coffee, and it was sold out of two brands I usually get. I mean, it's just the way it is. Then you go back and they're there, and then so when they are there, everybody's buying, you know, double because it might not be there the next time. So that's really what's happening. But Socrates is really the only functioning AI system that's monitoring the entire world. It puts every financial market globally, from Asia to Middle East, everything's in there. And it's tracking the capital flows, and it's making the forecast out of this on a very unbiased manner. You know, you can search our site. I mean, in 2013, we came out with the forecast and said the place where war is going to start is going to be Ukraine. And we warned that that is where World War III will begin to develop. And that's probably after 2025, as most likely when that's going to start. But, I mean, all our world leaders, all they're doing is cheering war. Nobody's asking for peace anymore. The Secretary of State of Romania quit. He said, you know, nobody wants to talk peace. And he just was so fed up and walked out. I think what's going on is that the monetary system is collapsing. And by that, what I mean is their ability to sell debt. As these interest rates are rising, institutions don't want to buy it because they know they're going to lose money next month on what they just bought this month. So everybody's moving shorter term and away from the longer term. And that's why Janet Yellen in the U.S. came out and was saying that maybe the Treasury should step in, buy the long term, and swap it with the short term. It's because there's a liquidity crisis developing. And, you know, you had interest rates at a 5,000-year historic low. And these people don't understand. As soon as the interest rates start to rise, all these bond portfolios lose money. If they're losing money, they can't afford to keep buying it. So, you know, really you have to shake them upside down, and even then you're questionable if our politicians will ever understand what they're doing. But I think that they're pushing for this war because basically what everybody's talking about behind the curtain is Bretton Woods too, and they default on all the debts. That's how they get out of it. And that's what Schwab's talking about. You own nothing and be happy. You know, he's trying to make it sound they're doing this for you. And they escape from their debt, which they have no intention of ever paying anything back. And they start all over again like they did after World War II. That's what they really have in mind. And the IMF, you can probably Google it. They're already, you know, lobbying to create the IMF digital currency, and they want that to be the new basic reserve currency of the world.
Is 32% real rate of inflation likely to put downward pressure on the U.S. dollar?
No. We have to understand that the pressure on the dollar will still be towards the upside until we see this global crisis and war expand more. As long as you have tensions going on in Europe, then capital flees here. The same thing's happening in Asia. You know, you had you know, North Korea is shooting missiles off even over Japan. You know, and you had China and North Korea coming out with agreements, and Russia and Iran coming out with agreements. So it's, you know, I don't see, you know, the logic in this at all, that these people are really floating with serious problems. And you can't back Russia or China, you know, into a corner. You just can't do this. I mean, even Henry Kissinger came out and said, give the Donbass back to Russia. They're 85% of the people there are Russian. I mean, Ukraine was never a country. It never had a country. All right. There are no Ukrainian historic coins. The first coin that even said Ukraine was basically issued by the German Nazis. And they joined the German Nazis because Hitler promised to give them a country. They're kind of, you know, in that respect, they're kind of like the Kurds in Iraq that want their own country, but, you know, it's Iraq. So this is the same thing. And so they're fighting basically for territory that was never theirs to begin with. And the people that are living there are Russian. And if you Google it, you'll find out that Zelensky has issued a decree that nobody can, you know, Russian language will no longer be accepted. He's been getting criticism over the last couple of weeks is when he left the U.S. and went back and then put in all kinds of censorship on the press. He's outlawed their religion. They're not allowed to report. Any churches are not allowed to continue to report to the Moscow Patriarch, which is kind of like their Pope in Orthodox, and he set up his own in Kiev. I mean, you're attacking people's religion, their language, and everything. I mean, this is not something that is very good, in my opinion. I agree with Kissinger. Let the Donbass go and end this. This is only going to get worse.
What do stock markets tend to do during periods of significant inflation?
It all depends, but they generally go up with inflation. if you know, people have been indoctrinated a lot with a lot of the Marxist agenda. When I was doing research for publishing a book back in '86, I had to read all the different newspapers. To do the greatest bull market. And it was very fascinating that before 1929, every time the Fed raised interest rates, everybody cheered. Because they said that proved that there was still a demand for money. When you get into a recession or a depression, what do? They immediately lower interest rates because nobody wants to borrow. And so it's opposite of what, you know, people tend to think. But now it's like, oh, gee, they're raising interest rates, so they don't want us to borrow. So we should be a good boy and not do that. But the whole problem with this is that when these theories were developed by Keynes in the 30s, the government had a balanced budget. Now the government is the elephant in the room. So you raise interest rates to stop inflation. Guess what? It doesn't work. Why? Because politicians do not say, oh, gee, we should be spending less because the Fed raised interest rates. No. It's just, you know, the budgets blow out, the interest expenditures go, and has no impact on governments other than makes them spend more.
Could the stock markets run higher into 2024?
Mainly in North America. Again, you have to understand that as geopolitical problems develop, further in Europe, the capital will flee Europe. That's what made the United States the largest economy and reserve currency. The U.S. was bankrupt at the end of the 19th century. J.P. Morgan had to lend $100 million in gold to the Treasury in 1896 to bail it out. And it was World War I that sent all the capital to the United States. And then World War II, by the time it was done, U.S. had 76% of the official world gold reserves. they were all running around in Europe blowing each other up. So there was nothing there. They all had to start over from scratch. But if it wasn't for Europe and its wars, the United States would still be a third world country, made up of mostly farmers.
Could significant inflation be by design, forcing people to own nothing and be happy about it in time for Agenda 2023?
I don't think so, largely because the risk of inflation here is that the higher it goes, the greater the civil unrest. Energy may have been up, it might cost me twice as much to fill my car up. I can survive. But in a third world country, that is the difference between starving and you can't put food on the table for your kids. That's why you see a lot of these civil unrest and uprisings are taking place around the world, from Southeast Asia, Peru, Brazil. You're looking at, Pakistan. All these places, it's because of energy increases. And in third world countries, they don't have a lot of social programs and things of this nature, and people have to actually work for a living.
Do significant periods of inflation cause people to focus their spending on necessities only?
Well, yes. You have the, particularly the retired people, the higher the inflation goes up on these necessity items, then they have less, discretionary spending elsewhere. What is clearly interesting, even like in the real estate, I was talking this morning with a couple of real estate agents down here in Florida, and the overwhelming sales, they put it at probably 70% or higher, all just cash deals anymore.
Historically, during significant inflation, have home prices gone up or down?
Typically, they will rise, all right, largely because you're looking at replacement costs, things of this nature. When a house declines in value relative to the cost to replace it, that's when you start seeing, some of the more abrupt increases, because people then figure that out. If you want to build a house, it will cost you, twice as much as buying one that somebody already has. So that provides a floor to that. And, you're not going to look at real estate rising, for example, in Europe, where tanks can be running down the streets, etc. That's when people, that sort of property value declines. Because there's too much of a geopolitical risk that attaches to it.
With 32% real inflation last year, should gold and silver be up 32%?
Well, gold never really rises according to inflation. If you look at historically, the big gold rallies from 1869 and all of them in 1980, it wasn't really inflation. That's more or less like a used car sales pitch. If you look at it, Russia invaded Afghanistan there in December 1979, and gold was about $400. All right, it doubled in price and went to $875 by January 21st. All right, it's geopolitical issues. It's concern about government and your confidence in government. And when you no longer trust government, that's when you turn to the private sector. And that's when precious metals actually perform what they're supposed to be, a hedge against the government, not inflation.
You'll be speaking at the World Outlook Conference February 3rd and 4th in Vancouver. Will you physically be in Vancouver?
Possibly. I don't know yet. I'm still working on to find out if you need vaccines or anything like that going up or coming back. But I'd like to be up there personally, yes.
Are we in World War III now?
No, but we're definitely moving in that area. Just yesterday, you had Belarus issue a decree for drafting all men from 18 to 60 years old. They're starting to prepare for war. China is, North Korea is, they know the West wants war. That simply is the way it is. There's just no question about that. If you look at every war, the first casualty of war is reporting the events. It's the first shot is always silent, and it's against the media. And the media starts putting out the propaganda. I mean, I put out 2 or 3 months ago, I said, my sources are very good. And I said, look, Ukraine has lost 100,000 soldiers. And everyone was, oh, that's not in the news. And then what just came out was that the head of the EU had put it in a speech, and then she had to take it out because Zelensky said that's classified information. Ukraine has been losing the war, not winning it. And everything they put out, oh, Russia's this, Russia's that, whatever. And you just had Lindsey Graham, I put it on our site. He came out and said, you have to understand Ukrainians will fight to the very last person. And that's what they're using them for. This is a war of attrition to basically wear down Russia. And then their plan, Poland has been told to increase its military and bring in 250,000 people for, drafting those people into the military. And they plan to invade Russia. As simple as that.
Martin, before we go, could you tell us a bit about Armstrong Economics and how people can sign up?
Well, our website is armstrongeconomics.com. You can go there. You don't have to register. It's a public service. We don't sell advertising, so you don't have to keep clicking on ads to get rid of them or anything else. We try to just put out that information on an unbiased manner, and we have very good sources around the world, and that's what we put in.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
And hopefully I'll see you in Vancouver.
I hope so.
My guest has been Martin Armstrong, founder of Armstrong Economics, online at armstrongeconomics.com. He was speaking to us from Florida. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC. His website, victoradair.ca. He's still very active in the markets. Welcome back to the show and Happy New Year.
Well, Jim, thank you for having me on, and Happy New Year back to you and to all your listeners.
And for people who follow the Orthodox calendar, Merry Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
During nearly every interview we did last year, you said it's all about the Fed. What did you mean by that, and does it still apply this year?
Yeah, I think last year it really was all about the Fed. The Fed had said for a while that the rising inflation was going to be transitory, that it was tied to, bottlenecks and supply chain issues because of COVID. And then after a while, they began to change their mind on that, and certainly the market was changing their mind on that before the Fed. And the Fed saw inflation was stickier than they thought it was going to be. They decided to start raising rates to try to cool inflation. And then they started to raise rates more aggressively because it wasn't working. And, you know, the market was keying off of that. What's the Fed going to do? And particularly, I think the market wanted to know, like, when is the Fed going to stop doing this? Because if we can figure that out, that'll be the sort of the green light special. That'll be the time to step in and buy risk assets, you know, stocks in particular. And you got to remember, I mean, we'd had just such a terrific rally, I guess, in the stock market for more than a decade. And in a way, you know, people were predispositioned to want to buy stocks. You know, stocks go up, and sometimes, you know, they go up a lot. So if you can turn on a green light, say it's time to buy, then, you know, folks want to jump in. So it really became, and that's in the stock market, all about the Fed. But because where interest rates are and with the Fed driving interest rate policy, you know, that matters to everything, whether it's commodities or, you know, stock market or bond market, and certainly the currency market as well. So, yeah, what the Fed was going to do was really, really the most important thing most of the time last year. And does it continue this year? Well, you know, that's going to be the $64 question. In my blog last week, I kind of speculated, and this is, I think, what traders do in a way. You just kind of go, well, what if that happened? And I wondered if, you know, let's say the old expression is the Maginot line, you know, if everybody's fighting the last war and all that kind of thing, if everybody's continuing to be riveted on what the Fed's doing, and they might not notice, you know, out of the corner of their eye, that something else is coming into the picture. So I thought, what could the something else be? And to me, the sort of the top candidate, I guess, for the Black Swan Award of this year, just might be some geopolitical stress. And when you look around the world, we got lots of flashpoints where that could happen. So, yeah, I think certainly as of today, you know, what the Fed is or isn't going to do is still hugely important. But I just wonder if something else might be lurking out there. And as I say, my candidate is geopolitical stress.
You were bullish on the U.S. dollar from January 2021 to around October last year. Then you started to have second thoughts about the U.S. dollar's strength. Where do you stand on the greenback now?
Well, you know, I am in that classic on the fence position. I was. The U.S. dollar had hit a 3-year low in January of 2021. You know, and we talked so many times, it was like that inflection point, as George Soros would call it, when the Capitol building was being stormed on January the 6th, and, you know, the whole world saw this happening. You know, here's the bastion of democracy and so on. And it was an inflection point. I think that the Rockefeller expression on that, or the Rothschild expression, I should say, was, you know, you got to buy when there's blood on the streets. The dollar had been weakening, in the few months leading up to that. You know, it had been bid during the panic, the COVID panic in March of 2020, and then it weakened. The real rally in the dollar since the lows in January of last of 2021 actually happened sort of from September of 2021 to September of last year of 22. In that 12-month period, the dollar went up about 20%. And I'm going to say there was kind of a combination of things, but out in front was the notion or the reality that the Fed was the most aggressive central bank in the world in terms of raising interest rates. And that started to draw capital to America, that flow of funds. You've heard me say so many times, capital comes to America for safety and for opportunity. So, in the currency markets, you get these trends, and they kind of feed on themselves, and then they blow out by making a V-shaped turn, whether it's a top or a bottom. So the dollar had got to a 20-year high. When I say the dollar, I mean the U.S. dollar index got to a 20-year high in September of last year, and it truly gone too far, too fast, and, you know, I was nervous about remaining bullish on it. Now, we've had a drop back since then, I guess, say, you know, in the range of 10% or so. I think year over year, the dollar was still up 8%. But what I've seen happening since September is there has been some flow of capital away from the USA. I've seen the euro, which had a 20-year low in September, has been aggressively bid by speculators. We can see that in the currency, the data on the currency futures markets. European stocks have definitely outperformed, European stock indices have outperformed American stock indices since last September. So there's been kind of a rush, in a way, from as the U.S. dollar peaked out and started to fall. Capital flowed the other way. I mean, just take, for instance, Europe last summer before September, you know, was looking to be a disaster. You know, they've got the war going on in Ukraine. There's this interruption, let's call it that, of energy flow from Russia. There's the prospect of Europe freezing to death in the dark, you know, at prices of different energy things, particularly natural gas and electricity, just soaring to unbelievable levels. Like, Europe just looked like a disaster. So when that started the turn, you know, I think that accelerated the flow of capital the other way. Where do we go from here? Boy, oh boy. You know, is that ever the $64 question? I don't know. I kind of think, if I go back to my first principle here where we started the talk, that maybe there's some geopolitical stress in the world. I mean, just for instance, okay? I mean, I think the Western press has painted a picture, or people tend to believe or want to believe, that the Ukrainians are prevailing in the war and the Russians are, you know, getting knocked back, and there's a side to all of us. We want to see the Russians get punished because blah, 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 you know, they started it and all that kind of thing. But if that's not the case, I mean, if that war takes a turn for the worse, then it, you know, the market isn't prepared for that. And that's, as a trader, that's what I look all the time, you know, is the market prepared that something different is going to happen, something dramatically different is going to happen? So whether it's, you know, Ukraine or in Asia or certainly the Middle East, if there's a crisis that gets people worried, that's almost always good for the U.S. dollar. So failing a crisis, you know, I kind of think that this year ahead is probably just going to be a choppy market, whatever you're in, you know, whether it's stocks, bonds, currencies, stocks, bonds, currencies, and commodities. I just kind of sense we're going to have a choppy market, but be prepared for whatever happens.
The stock market had a fantastic rally from 2009 to late 2021, but the leading stock market indices were down last year, and some of the more speculative issues fell dramatically. What do you see for this year?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the more spectacular issues or speculative issues, I mean, Tesla comes to mind. I noted in my blog this last week, and I had some data there, that Tesla, and this surprised me, was the most bought stock in the United States. I thought, really? Okay. But Tesla, from its highs, and I think the highs were probably November of 2021, to the recent lows, is down 75%. I mean, that's a pretty dramatic tumble. You know, maybe not at the other end of the scale, but Apple, I think, is down over 30% from its highs to its lows. You know, Apple was such, like, it was the granddaddy of all the stocks, you know, the largest market cap and everything else. So, yeah, we had the markets down, and, you know, again, in my blog last week, pointing out some of the longer-term charts, we'd gone up so far so fast. The NASDAQ, from the lows in 2009 to the highs at the end of 2021, was up 15x. I mean, that is astonishing. And gee, do you think maybe we were due for a correction? So, you know, we got a correction. I guess the NASDAQ was down about 37% last year, and had given back about 60% or so of the rally it had off the COVID lows in March of 2020. I think in a bigger picture view of the world that the bond market had all-time high interest rates back in the Paul Volcker era, 1980, 81, that sort of thing. And for the next 40 years, interest rates trended lower and lower and lower, and that underwrote the greatest rally in the stock market since, you know, they invented sliced bread or whatever. Just, it was the lower and lower and getting lower interest rates really supported a rising stock market. And I think we're in a new era here. And I know that's, you should be nervous if you ever find yourself saying that, but I think we just had, you know, decades of low interest rates and low inflation. And I think that changes going forward. So that kind of leads to my thought, as I said earlier, about just choppy markets here as we try to adapt to a new environment of higher interest rates and higher inflation and capital flows to go with that. So yeah, we had a hell of a run in the stock market, and the cherry on top, in a way, was the run from the COVID lows to the, you know, the highs at the end of 2021 or the very beginning of 2022. And you know, I would say unlikely we're going to see those highs again anytime soon. And I guess I'm also sort of predisposed, and this is just a bias, this is not a trading strategy, but I'm predisposed to think we may take out the lows that we made last year. But broadly speaking, I'm expecting just lots of chop as we go forward.
I've seen some reports that say the bond market had its worst year in decades in 2022. Do you agree? And what do you think bonds will do this year?
I think absolutely the bonds had their worst year in forever last year. And, you know, that just a terrible year. Now, right now, the bond market has been coming off of its lows. This is yields been falling, bond prices have been rising a bit here the past couple of months. And I think part of that is the bond market probably got driven down too hard and coming back a bit. But also the bond market, looking ahead, has been seeing a recession coming. And the bond market, you know, loves the thought of a recession. There'll be some capital would maybe move from the stock market to the bond market if we're going into a recessionary environment. There'll be some of that. On the other hand, you know, the bond market doesn't like inflation, and certainly doesn't like if we get into a situation where the government is printing lots more bonds to finance deficit spending. So I could see a choppy year in bonds as well. And then there's just so many more bonds outstanding now than even, let's say, 10 years ago. And a big chunk of those bonds, by big chunk, well, I'm going to say probably ballpark 20%, are foreign-owned. And if there's weakness in the U.S. dollar or, again, another geopolitical crisis, I mean, you think maybe the Chinese didn't learn something when the Americans blocked the Russians' access to their capital, you know, kicking them out of the SWIFT system. So maybe the Chinese, who are huge holders of bonds, might want to sell some of those. So I think there's, in the very short term, the bond market is catching a bid because of the prospect of a recession. But then what happens in a recession, in other words, let's say government stimulus programs, issuing of more debt might put a drag on bonds. So depends on your time frame there. But yes, they did have a terrible year. And that's particularly important to pension funds, who often have a high weighting of bonds. And now they can carry their bonds on the balance sheet, on their asset list, I should say, as you know, at face value, usually if they're government bonds. But still, with the payouts going up because of cost of living adjustments for the pension funds, and the value of their assets, stocks and bonds largely, and we'll see as we go forward here as they start to put some prices on their private equity holdings. It must have been just a really tough year for a lot of pension funds last year because bonds were down so much.
I saw your report on gold on your blog last week. You noted that gold hit an all-time high in March 2022 on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, then fell over $400 to the September lows, then it rallied back to close the year nearly precisely where it started the year, around 1830. This week's gold closed around 1875 an ounce, an eight-month high. What are your thoughts on gold in this new year?
Well, I noticed last year that there's two broad markets that I look at for gold. One is the ETF market, both domestic and then global, and then the futures market. And in the ETF market, there was a spike of gold demand on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which would be, for people that follow the gold market, very understandable. Gold often gets bid aggressively on a scare of some kind like that. But for the year as a whole, the ETF market was net sellers. And the futures market, the open interest of the amount of, let's say, position sizing that people wanted to have, also gave me the idea that people had kind of lost interest in gold. And of course, that might be a wonderful time for something to happen that was bullish for gold, and prices start to go up, and people that were not paying attention go, oh my gosh, I got to get in there too. So we've had a run up in gold, as you say, to an 8-year high. I've also said on your show here many times over the past couple of years that gold has been is usually a strong negative correlation to the U.S. dollar. So to put that in this perspective, as the U.S. dollar has been weakening since late September, it's been highly correlated to strength in the gold market. And at the end of this week here, the U.S. dollar was weak again, and gold, hit a new high. Gold has also, over the past 5-6 years in particular, had a pretty good correlation with interest rates, real rates in particular. But the past few months here, that hasn't been a factor at all. And that's one of the things that happens with correlations between markets, is they work and then they stop working. So it's usually not a good idea to buy something, say, because something that is usually correlated to has gone up. So then that's just the time when the correlations stop working. The key thing here, I think, is the gold market, which was kind of ignored or neglected for a good part of last year, certainly after the Russian invasion in the spring, was kind of ripe for a something, and it's had something here, and the something has been a weaker U.S. dollar has given the gold market a good lift. Now, again, to go back to what I talked about at the top of this interview, I'm thinking maybe a geopolitical event will sort of steal the show this year and make it not so much. It's only the Fed that's the thing to be concerned about. If we get another geopolitical scare, that could put another bid in the gold market. So I don't own gold right now. I was too slow. I missed it. As a matter of fact, I was predisposed to think the U.S. dollar might catch a bid, and I have been trading the U.S. dollar from the long side, and I've made some money on that. But, gold's had a good pop here, and, I'll have to have another look at it, see if I want to get in at this point.
Energy prices had a dramatic roller coaster ride last year with extreme price swings in natural gas and electricity. Will we see more of those wild swings again this year?
Well, the wild swings, for folks that don't follow these markets closely, you have no idea. The energy price swings in Europe in particular were just incredible. We had some pretty dramatic action in natural gas, for instance, in the United States. I think between August and the end of the year, nat gas prices fell 60%. And that's not like a penny mining stock. That's natural gas, and that volatility was literally dwarfed by the volatility we had in the European energy markets. Another aspect of that volatility is that I saw that the participation, again, the open interest in all of the energy futures markets that I follow was way down in some cases down to, you know, multi-year lows. And I think a good part of that is, you know, anybody that didn't have to be involved in the market said, this is just way too crazy for me. You know, I could be dead right about what I think, but I could step in there at just the wrong time and lose my shirt. So I don't want to touch it. And when liquidity comes out of a market, then, you know, it sort of exacerbates the volatility. So yeah, it was a really amazingly volatile year with these big price swings. Are we going to see more of that this year? You know, I don't know. Certainly the underlying story on the energy markets is always about supply demand, but the scary side is, you know, is the supply really there? And in some respects, like in Europe, the key word was, or the key words were energy security. Suddenly, with the war starting in Ukraine, the interruption of what was going to be, what was assumed to be a safe flow of energy from Russia to Western Europe was so dramatically interrupted. And that was just like the existential crisis. Holy mackerel. What are we going to do? Freeze to death in the dark here. I mean, I loved that the Germans were able to build a floating LNG, import terminal in 6 months. You know, it reminds me of the old saying in the commodity markets is that the best cure for high prices is high prices, because it causes innovation, it causes swapping things for, you know, something else, and it causes people to get the job done, you know, get her done, as they would say. So, amazing volatility. We are going into this year, as we've been here for the past couple of years, with a very delicate balance, I guess, between supply and demand. I mean, the prospect, let's say just China, if the reopening of China and the subsequent ballooning of COVID in the country causes them to import less energy from other places, and let's just say LNG and crude oil, and throw in coal from Australia, you know, then that weakens the markets. If the recovery from the COVID bloom out here happens fairly quickly, and they go back to being, you know, the locomotive for global growth, while India is also, and other parts of the emerging markets are also demanding, you know, we're going to have scarcity. And again, the key on the supply-demand side is there's just not that huge reservoir of inventory that could, you know, come in and meet if there's an interruption of supply from some source. So I would anticipate that it's not going to be a quiet year in the energy markets, but it would almost be hard to imagine that the price swings going forward could be as dramatic as they were this past year, particularly, you know, in like natural gas and electricity in the European markets.
I wonder if we could get those German engineers to work on BC's LNG export plants. They seem to be taking forever.
Yeah, but it seems as though, and, you know, don't hold me to this, but it seems as though we'll have an export capacity or facility that'll be functioning by 2025, and, you know, that's not that far away now. I guess it's 2 years away. I guess, you know, when the prospect of your citizens freezing to death in the dark is staring you in the face, you don't let a lot of trivial issues get in your way and you say, get her done. We have the luxury in a way that we can try to satisfy all the stakeholders and everybody has to get their two bits worth in, and then that's just how it is. So yeah, it's been a long and winding road to have an export facility, but you know, it's good. Exporting energy is the biggest part of Canada's export income, you know, and we have all this spending we want to do. So I think it would be wonderful if we could generate income so we could finance that spending rather than just putting it on the tap.
You've been trading markets for 50 years, and you like to say that you make money by managing risk, not by having a great crystal ball. When we were wrapping up our interview last month, you had a mini rant about how people lose money by getting sucked into believing stories, and I would think of all the ads featuring celebrities telling you to get into SPX. Or do you have any more thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, that, you know, I have never traded Bitcoin. I didn't ever pretend that I had any understanding of it. And, you know, I've got more than enough to do with the markets that I do pay attention to. I'm sort of global macro is my view on things. But, you know, I also never bought any of the marijuana stocks. And, you know, there was a lot of stories there. And back when I was a kid going to university, the things that I were trading were penny mining stocks on the Vancouver Stock Exchange. And I learned very early that, you know, sometimes people just plain lie to you. So, you know, and then other folks just get caught up in the hype. I mean, where to start with that? I guess, let's start with this. When interest rates were near zero for years, and in some cases negative, that caused people who should have been savers. You know, like I remember my mom and my grandma had all of their savings in the credit unions. And at that time, you could get north of 12% for a GIC. You know, that's what I mean by a saver. But when those same folks arrive at a spot where their GIC is zero, and they say, gee, we got to do something, and you hear Harry down at the barbershop or something said he's making all kinds of money in Breathless Resources or whatever. And when the stock market is rising, we had, you know, those beautiful acronyms like FOMO, the fear of missing out, and TINA, there is no alternative. You know, you got to be in the stock market. And when people chase stuff, valuation just goes out the window. You've heard me say so many times, I don't know. And I just always kind of got to a point where if somebody is telling me, or I'm reading about that, somebody knows where a market is going, I just think they're delusional. You know, you have no idea. I mean, you may have half a dozen reasons why such and such could happen. Yeah, well, you think you're the only guy that thought of those things? Is that not already in the price? And so on and so on. You know, there's an old saying for salesmen, right? If you want to sell a product, tell a good story, because people love a good story. And I'm going to say nobody knows. Now, so to make it simple then, I would say to folks, you know, just do not buy anything until you figured out where you will get out of it if it doesn't work out. So you're going to buy something at $10 a share, and because you think, you know, the promoter or whatever is saying it's going to go a hell of a lot higher, well, where do you bail out? Or if it goes down to, you know, 75 cents, do you just kind of dump it into your RSP and try to forget about it? You know, there's just this whole thing about people want to have somebody tell them what's going to happen. And I'm going to say nobody knows. So if somebody tells you what's going to happen, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Now, obviously, the markets do move around. And if you happened to be on the right side of a move, you can make a lot of money. That's kind of the draw. So, you know, you can take the appropriate amount of money to speculate with, if that's what you're doing. And so if you happen to lose all of it, you know, it's not going to destroy your lifestyle. And yes, any success that I've had in trading, and it comes and goes, has been the result of managing risk rather than thinking that I know better than other people what's going to happen.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, you know how to wind me up. I just believe that so much. I mean, I was in the brokerage business for 45 years or something, and I saw a lot of people lose a lot of money. And I used to say one of my set pieces when I would be doing presentations was I watched all these people lose all that money, and I thought, what is it that they do? What is it that they have in common? And it was really simple. They didn't have a plan as to what they were going to do if things didn't go the way they hoped. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do the opposite of that. I am ruthless. about getting out of something that's not working, whether I put it on and, you know, and you have to have your time frame, of course. You know, you buy something and if it's not up in 5 minutes, well, you know, maybe it's 5 days for you or 5 weeks, whatever, but you have to have that time horizon. But, yeah, I do lose money on more of the trades that I make than I make money on. And yet I can still come out ahead because keep the losses small. Anyway, that's enough of that. Jim, thanks very much. Happy New Year to you and to all your listeners. And thank you for having me on.
My guest has been Victor Adair. Check out his website, victoradair.ca. He was speaking to us from Parksville, Vancouver Island, BC. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Armstrong, and Victor Adair. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarko Masalgia. He's the CEO of Recyclico. Welcome back to the show, Zarko. Merry Christmas. If you're following the Orthodox calendar, Happy New Year to everybody. And the best of whatever you like to celebrate, I guess.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. Merry Christmas. That's right, for myself as well. And Happy New Year to everyone.
Zarko, what's up and coming for the new year?
Well, we've really hit the ground running. And to be honest with you, it feels like it never really stopped over the holidays. But I think the new year is off to a fantastic start for Recyclico. And I couldn't be more excited for the next stage of our growth. You know, the holidays really gave me a chance to take a step back and take a really a good look at the industry and our strategic path. And you know, I'm really even more confident how well we are, you know, positioned to the many exciting opportunities on the horizon. You know, and I really, these days, I really wake up with a lot to look forward to really every day. And I'm not bogged down by the daily share price. And, you know, I know I don't mention it much in these podcasts, but in reality, since 2020, I've seen the stock as low as 10 cents and as high as $2.80. But despite the ups and downs in the market, you know, we really remained focused on building these strong business relationships and maintaining our lead in innovation and technical expertise. And as I've said many times, you know, the EV and battery revolution is really just getting started. And I know the Recyclico is poised to really play a major role, in the long future of this industry that's really, like I mentioned, only getting started. And you really have to, when you think about all this, you really have to reflect on where we were in those days and our current position now to put it all in context, right? Like, for example, look at our demonstration plant. It's really second to none, one of a kind kind of facility. You know, we have our comprehensive life cycle assessment that's shown really positive environmental benefits using our process. And then you have our third-party validation of the product, which really speaks to the quality, and all of this really speaks to the quality and sustainability of our work. And then on top of that, with $20 million in cash, right, we have the resources to continue innovating and staying ahead of the competition. And that's, you know, really a great position to be in, given some of the market conditions right now. But, you know, I'm also excited to be back on the road more frequently, even starting as early as next week. And, you know, this to meet with potential partners and investors, but also, you know, on the flip side of these things, having a lot of visitors come to us where we can showcase our cutting edge technology, you know, firsthand in Vancouver. And, you know, I'm a big believer that there's nothing quite like the experience, nothing quite like experiencing our demonstration plant in person. And I'm confident that these kind of touch and feel interactions will be key to securing even more exciting deals and partnerships. And, you know, as, starting off the new year, as CEO, I am committed to leading Recyclico to even greater success and growth. I have a deep understanding of the industry and technology and have built strong relationships that will serve us well as we move forward. And I want to thank those of you who have also expressed your confidence in my ability to lead the company. And just want to, you know, say here's to a bright and exciting future for Recyclico.
Zarko, can you maybe explain the process the company has developed and has patents for people who are new to Recyclico?
Yeah, you know, Recyclico has developed a hydrometallurgical process, which is more of like a wet chemistry of extracting lithium, nickel, manganese, and cobalt from lithium-ion battery waste material, but not just extracting this material, but also now upcycling it into the high-value battery-ready materials such as cathode precursors, lithium hydroxide, lithium carbonate, that are to a quality that we've shown and has been validated by third parties that can be used in new lithium-ion battery cells. In essence, creating a circular economy for the critical battery materials that we need for the future of our electrification goals.
Zarko, where are you traded and where can people get more information about the company?
Oh, we're traded on the Toronto Venture Exchange, Toronto Venture Exchange under the ticker symbol AMY. We're traded on the OTCQB under AMYZF and the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under ID4. And you can get more information on our website, www.recyclico.com. There you'll see a lot more new updates on our website. Also on our social media, you know, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, you'll see a lot more of information coming out, just kind of education around the industry and terminology. So kind of keep your eyes peeled for those things.
Zarko, thank you so much for the update and best of the season.
Thanks, Jim.
I've been speaking with Zarko Masalgia. He's the CEO of Recyclico. Our conversation took place on January 6th. I'm Jim Goddard.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.